It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, today it's bliss for coffee lovers and those of us with control issues. Now, if you want the very best cup of coffee, you need to roast it yourself. According to our guest, coffee roasting expert Kenneth Davids, you can do it at home in 8 minutes, no less. Well, the Stearns have found great saddles and fabulous beef burritos in Billings, Montana. She of the ever-elegant, ever-simple culinary solution, Sally Schneider, talks the mysterious quince. Then it's everything you need to know about buying shrimp but didn't know to ask from food writer Olivia Wu. And an Indian master chef discovers a cook's vision is not necessarily in the eyes. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today we have the man who wrote the Bible on home coffee roasting, the essential skill for the coffee obsessed. But even for we inept types, this is doable. Think 8 minutes of your time and two cracks. Kenneth Davids is author of Home Coffee Roasting, Romance and Revival. San Francisco Chronicle food writer Olivia Wu has everything you need to know about buying shrimp. Quince lover Sally Schneider has the one thing you need to know to enjoy the most sensual fruit in the market. And speaking of sensual, an Indian chef who was almost blinded takes a class of visually impaired folks into visions of palate. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we hope to hear from you folks at WVXU in Cincinnati. Welcome aboard, guys. Well, let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we just got back from Billings, Montana, where we had a moment that was at first incredibly disappointing and then wonderfully rewarding. The moment was we went to an old favorite restaurant of ours called El Burrito. It used to bill itself as the working person's eating place in Billings. We got there, and El Burrito was gone. And at that, our hearts sunk. You know, this happens sometimes, you know, as we travel. However, it had been replaced by a place called Sarah's. We walked in, looked at the menu on the wall, and realized that Sarah's was, in fact, the same place. And it had been renamed in honor of one of the owners who had passed away recently. Her two sisters continue to run it, and it still is one of the greatest places to eat Mexican food in the Great Plains.
So El Burrito lives, right?
It does. It more than lives. It flourishes. And have you ever been to Billings?
No, Billings? I haven't. And I, you know, I have a picture of Billings, Montana, as being a place where you can still tie your horse to a hitching post.
Not quite.
Not at all. It's very much a little city. In fact, when we were staying there the last time, I think we were, I forget what the tall hotel downtown is, but we were staying there. And across from us was the traveling touring company of cats. And they were like dancing and shrieking in the hallway until 2 a.m. So it felt very cosmopolitan. But
on the other hand, I mean, it really does have some great remnants of its Old West character. In our two favorite saddles were made by Chaz Weldon, who is a really terrific saddle maker who works out of Billings.
You guys turned me on to a saddle maker in Sheridan, Wyoming. And I have to say, I don't ride anymore, and even if you never rode, to see how a saddle maker works, I think that's utterly fascinating. I mean, can you go in and actually watch the process with this guy?
Oh, you have. I mean, that's part of the deal. I mean, I don't know how Chaz Weldon ever gets anything done, because all day long in his studio, people are coming and going, and he's shooting the breeze, and most of the time, he's too preoccupied with the conversation to work on the saddles.
But you know, can we get back to the El Burrito,
yes,
place?
Yes, let's really talk about what you eat there,
yeah,
because
yeah.
The smothered beef burrito there is spectacular. It is a meal. It's really a meal for two, unless you have a huge appetite.
Unless you're one of us.
Unless you're one of us. I mean, it's loaded. You know, it's not with that like ground beef. It's like big hunks of pot roast tender beef, topped with a great kind of red chili. I mean, pure flavorful chili, and you know the tortilla wrap is like is just enough to sort of balance all that meat and some beans and cheese within. It's just a fabulous dish to eat.
And major guacamole, too. It's very garlicky. I don't know if that's considered kind of sacrilege by guacamole purists, but man, it is delicious.
Oh, and one other thing I have to mention is the taquitos. Now, these are things that in other parts of the West might be called flautas. You know, those tightly wrapped, crisp fried tortilla tubes that contain that same moist shredded meat and nothing else.
Right.
There's something so succulent about crunching into one of those things. And the ones that they have at Sarah's are some of the best.
Okay, so we go watch the saddles, and then we go and eat. And
sit on the saddles.
Ride the saddle.
Ride the wild saddle.
Come a tie ya yip. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend. where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum weed. Back in the saddle again.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can tune into their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, emails are coming in from all kinds of food groups trying to help the thousands of restaurant and hospitality workers affected by Katrina. Now, we've not been able to vet all sources, but some that we feel are reliable are starchefs.com, southernfoodways.com, and jamesbeard.org. Now, these sites have places to post jobs or to search for them. They've got fundraising activities and lists of places to make contributions. Also, keep your eyes peeled because food people across the country are going to be doing benefit dinners. I mean, this is a really easy way to contribute, especially if you're going to go out to eat anyway. Well, for information, check out our website, splendidtable.org. There's an effortless elegance to food writer Sally Schneider's food. It's always simple, but there's always an original twist. Sally's book is A New Way to Cook. Hey, Sally, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Sally, quince season is opening up. Most people are really put off by these babies. I mean, it's a fruit, but it feels like a rock. So what do you do with them? How do you handle them?
Well, Lynn, I learned about quinces many years ago by accident. Well, a sort of planned accident. I was a chef in a little place, and there was a fruit market next door, and I used to walk by every morning. And one morning, the proprietor, Angelo, yelled at me, "Hey, Sally, you ever seen a quince before?" And he hurled one at me. And I luckily caught this fruit that looked like a yellow apple. And smelled, though, as I walked into the restaurant, I thought, my God, like pear, banana, guava, flowers.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly.
So I thought, I got to figure this out. He hadn't told me a thing about it. I had never dealt with quinces before. So, of course, I peel it. It's a fruit. I cut a little piece off, as hard as it was. I put it in my mouth. I felt like I had licked deodorant. My whole mouth dried up. I could not taste a thing. Well, the thing, that's the first lesson about quinces. They have to be cooked. They're really hard. Inside looks like an apple, but it's very hard. And if you want to release all that fragrance that you smell when you're just holding them in your hand, you mm-hmm. have to cook them. So I divined my way. I don't know what made me do this, but for my money, it became the way I have always cooked quinces to then use them for other things. And that is, I cook them in white wine with some honey and a couple of strips of fruit peel. Now, what that mixture I've come to call faux dessert wine, because that's what it tastes like when you just mix it up. And dessert wines are wonderful for cooking fruit, and it works in the same way. So what I cook the quinces, simmered them, and these, of course, were peeled and cut up,
right,
for about 40 minutes. And in the course of that time, they turned this incredible rosy color and got meltingly tender and creamy. And all that perfume was there, but now it was a flavor. It was really great. So I do that when I want to use quinces for savory dishes or for sweet dishes, because dessert wines or wines in general, when you use them with fruit, helps them to go in either direction. So these cooked quinces are fabulous right off the bat as an accompaniment to roast pork, duck, chicken, quail, just about any game bird. Actually, lamb, as they do in the Middle East, is wonderful. I mean, you can kind of just use your imagination about how you want to use this. They also like herbs, so you can embellish them with that. In the other direction, just as they are, they're great with creme fraiche or ice cream. I warm them up a bit first, or crushed raspberries and that sort of thing.
Right, right.
They're also great, though, for improvising wonderful, very impressive desserts. They're already cooked. Throw them in a pre-baked tart shell with some creme fraiche, and you have a wonderful quince tart. keep them in the frying pan and heat them up and caramelize them a bit, and then cover them with pastry and bake them, and you have basically a quince tatin. You can do the same thing pouring a cake batter over to make an upside-down quince cake. Add a few slices of quince, thinly sliced, because they cook more, they're much denser, to an apple pie, and it will give its fragrance to the apple pie.
And this is all that cooked quince.
Well, that one, actually, I would do, you know, actually, even easier if you have the cooked one to throw into the apple pie. But if you have a quince, cut it up thinly and put it in a, you know, raw and put it in apple
right.
pie.
It'll
now,
cook
you
it.
Can cook these cooked quinces down further to make a jam if you want, or a kind of sauce for pancakes and that sort of things. They're also great just the way they are, served like membrillo, which is the Spanish quince paste, which is you know, thick jam. But you can eat these roasted quinces with manchego cheese for a very kind of sophisticated dessert. And they're just beautiful. Oh, one more thing. Mash them and freeze them. Throw them in the food processor and you have a quince sorbet. Add some heavy cream or creme fraiche and it becomes a quince ice cream.
That's a great idea. And you get all that wine and honey and, oh, that sounds great.
And it's all from one basic technique.
So how long will those cooked quinces keep in the fridge?
A couple of weeks at least, because they are sort of preserved with the wine and honey. You can also freeze them. Also, I cook them so that the wine and honey evaporates, but if you cook them in a syrup and have them submerged in that wine honey syrup, they will last for months.
So you can then pull them out and do whatever you want with them.
Exactly, which is what we want.
Exactly. Hey, thanks.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can find Sally's recipe for her basic cooked quince at splendidtable.org. Now, while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Each week, we send you a quick worknight supper recipe. This week, it's the last summer supper salad. It's a big and fast cash-in on the last great tomatoes and green beans. And we always send along shopping and technique tips. Best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, roast your own bean, coffee that is, and buying shrimp. The good news and the not so good news. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store, and Target in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. You know, I'm wondering if coffee is getting like wine. I mean, it's so much more quality specific than it used to be. You've got coffee terroir, varietal coffees, and if you listen to the coffee mavens, while the bean's important, it's the roast that can make or break a great cup. And fresh roasted is so key. Companies put roast dates on their bins. Well, it doesn't get much better than roasting it yourself. I mean, just like our great-grandparents used to do. Now, the Bible for do-it-yourself coffee roasting is by Kenneth Davids. It's called Home Coffee Roasting, Romance and Revival, and he's just updated it. Hey, Kenneth, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, I love books like yours. You cover every nuance, every element. It's like the Bible, as I said. But
if I have got a great coffee shop on the corner, why do I need to roast my own coffee?
Well, for one thing, unless the shop on the corner actually roasts right in the store, which is rather unusual, your coffee won't be that fresh, really. It certainly won't be as fresh as if you roast it yourself and drink it immediately or drink it the next day. And I think the other thing is that it's just part of the mystery and romance of food. When we love a food or a beverage, we want to understand it and engage in it as deeply and as with as much immediacy as possible. So that's another appeal.
I just keep thinking of the aroma of roasting coffee. What are the steps? How do you actually go about doing this?
It's relatively simple, really. It's like maybe making a really good omelet.
Mm-hmm.
The beans need to be agitated while they're being heated so that they don't roast unevenly or burn. They need to be heated, obviously. They need to be cooled right away. And you have to have a way of getting rid of the roasting smoke, which is very pleasant at first, but it can get a little cloying after a while.
So you really need great ventilation.
Well, all you need is the usual fan and hood over a range.
How long does it usually take?
Well, in these small quantities that you roast at home, it takes about 3 minutes at the fastest to about 8 minutes.
Oh, so it's really quick.
10 minutes, perhaps.
Is there an optimum temperature that you've got to get the beans?
Well, it's hard to measure the temperature because it depends how the heat's transferred to the beans.
Uh-huh.
But in general, you want to avoid the two B's, baking and burning.
Okay.
You want it to actually roast and not bake. You know, there's not enough heat, the beans just sort of sit there and gradually, sullenly get brown, and they never really roast. They never start what we call the first crack, which is the initiation of roasting. It's a kind of a popping like popcorn. And the burning, of course, you apply too much heat too fast and burns
right,
the beans.
Right. Now, you start out with green coffee beans. Where do you get these?
The Internet is the most popular place to get them now because it's a product that, unlike roasted coffee, has good shelf life. There are lots of websites that sell green beans. But also you can go into your the corner shop and see whether you can buy some green beans.
Now, can we do this just with a skillet on top of the stove?
Sure. It's not the best way, but you can get a remarkably tasty roast that way. It's also not the most... It's not automated, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
you have to stand over it and keep pushing the beans around. I mean, a wok works the best, or a wok-style frying pan, so that the beans are a little bit more concentrated in the bottom. And then a flat-edged spatula, and you put about three beans deep.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
The heat is about the heat that it would take to do moist scrambled eggs. It's a kind of intermediate heat. You have to sort of experiment, obviously. But if it works right and you're pushing the beans around, you should get that first crack, which is very unmistakable.
Right.
You should get that in about 3 minutes or so after you start. And then there's a lull, and then there's what we call a second crack, which is more like crinkling paper. And the smoke gets more pungent and roastier. Smelling, that's the second crack. Most people stop the roast at the beginning of the second crack.
And then you have to spread it out on something to get it cooled down really fast.
Well, you toss it into a colander usually.
Okay. How long will those beans give you a great cup of coffee? How long could I keep my own roasted beans?
Well, the peak is in about a day.
So ideally do a small amount to just have for one day.
Well, no, 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
But
right.
Well, the reason I hesitated is because it tastes differently from day to day. That's one of the pleasures. And when it's really fresh, there's something remarkable about coffee that's a day out of the roaster. It'll still taste good after 3 days, but it won't have that particular bloom that you have to taste to understand.
I think you've hooked me. I've got to try this. Kenneth, thank you.
You're welcome.
Kenneth Davids is author of Home Coffee Roasting, Romance and Revival. Now, you can find his suggestion for a home roaster on the website, splendidtable.org. Shrimp has transcended its origins. I mean, people say they hate fish, but they love shrimp. It's not fish. It's shrimp. I mean, I don't think there is any other form of fish that is this adorable. Yet in certain circles, this little creature is controversial, and for all of us, it can be confusing. You see, not all shrimp are created equal. Well, for some solid research, we have with us San Francisco Chronicle food writer Olivia Wu. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Olivia, when we order shrimp, what are we getting?
If you're not paying a whole lot for it, if you're going to the all-you-can-eat counter, you're likely getting a shrimp that's imported, and either from East Asia, Southeast Asia, or Latin America, and it is likely farmed shrimp. And so those two things already can tell us quite a bit about the kind of shrimp you're eating.
What do they tell us?
Well, one, farming is bad for a lot of shores. It's destructive to the ecosystem. And then apparently new research has been coming out that a lot of these countries are using antibiotics, chemicals, and other things that are banned in the U.S. for farmed shrimp, for example.
Well, what about domestic farmed shrimp?
There's a little of it going on in Hawaii, also in Georgia and Texas, and they are trying to do it sustainably. It ends up being very expensive shrimp. I mean, you're looking at, oh, maybe $18, $19 a pound, if you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small fledgling industry, as opposed to, you know, I can go to my local Asian supermarket here, and it's $5.99, or
yeah,
even in my local grocery store, it's $6.99, $5.99. So that's a huge difference, huge difference.
Is there ever wild shrimp on the market, or is it all farmed?
There is wild shrimp, and you know, Lynn, that's the sad thing about it. Shrimp, if you think about it, are kind of like the insects of the sea. They're little critters that in tropical waters especially take, 8 months to a year to come to maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were harvested well and carefully, we would have an endless supply of wild, good-tasting shrimp. But unfortunately, the current and conventional standards of harvesting them are not very good. They hurt the ocean floor. They take up a lot of bycatch. Bycatch means they catch other fish, other stuff. Some people estimate as much as half of a catch. Say you're raising a huge net with a couple of hundred pounds, 500 pounds, 250 pounds of that is just dead stuff they're going to throw away to get to the shrimp. So it's an awful lot of waste.
Is anybody doing this in a way that doesn't cause this kind of harm?
Well, we are kind of one of the leaders of that. There are shrimp that are caught in traps, and the traps are configured in a way that the turtles and other stuff can swim free, and only the shrimp are remaining. That's become law in the United States, although, you know, in the very, very messed up way that the states all have different laws and regulations. I can't say it's universal, but in general, that's true.
Now, we go to the supermarket, we buy a bag of frozen shrimp. Is there any of this information on the label?
It is now required that those labels say what country and whether it's wild or farmed. So you know that right away.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't say anything about how it's been caught, right?
Well, if it's caught in the U.S., you're doing okay. It's by bycatch-free, a turtle-free kind of device. So that's become, you can count on that pretty much now.
Okay. You've done a tasting of different kinds of shrimp, tiger prawns and or tiger shrimp and prawns and green shrimp. What were some of your favorites?
The far runaway success was the local, what's called the spot prawns, which are caught in California in traps, which are free of bycatch. And you get them live. Here we can go to high-end stores or the Asian markets that keep them live in the tanks, and in Chinese restaurants, for example. And those were just succulent. They tasted like little lobsters. They were beautiful to look at, and that was the runaway success.
But I don't live in San Francisco. Let's face it, the chances of my seeing a live shrimp are probably slim to none. So was there a second that was not too bad?
Another shrimp I liked a great deal was another wild-caught shrimp called the, in Oregon, they're called pinks, and they're little tiny shrimp. They're the kind that you get in salads.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tiny little ones, very delicate. Sometimes you can get them fresh, but they're even good frozen. Some other wild ones, which had been frozen, didn't do so well. There's so much handling involved when you're buying a wild shrimp. Say in California, if I get something from Georgia, Florida, or Texas, it's been flown here. And so the quality is uneven. I'd have to say, as far as taste was concerned, the farm shrimp that we just picked up randomly at our local stores were more of a more even consistency. So I think the lesson there is, if you're buying wild shrimp from other places that come from the southeast or the south of this country, really go to a reputable fishmonger.
Okay. Olivia, thank you.
Happy shrimp eating. And come here and let us serve you some.
Be there in about an hour.
I saw three shrimps in the water. Two were old and gray, so I swam a little closer, and I heard the third one say, "Goodbye, mommy shrimp." The papa shake my hand. Here comes a shrimp boat full to take me.
Olivia Wu is food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her article on shrimp appeared on April 13th, 2005. People bring many things with them when they become a professional cook. Some things are learned through hard knocks, some are learned in a classroom or a kitchen, and some simply come through the years lived and things endured. Chef Vikas Khanna had an accident as a teenager that changed his entire perception of flavor. Reporter Rachel Bonham Carter joined him at a tasting workshop for people with visual impairments.
I was 17 when I was traveling south of India. And this was the first time of leaving my region where I grew up all my life. I am sitting in the train and something hit my left eye and it just left me almost blind. I'm traveling south now. I don't want to give up. I don't want to break my journey because I'm going for the final interview for my hotel management school, which I dreamt of all my life. I make it to the south. I can't speak the language. I don't understand anything, but I have to eat to survive. When I was eating, I could understand that they had such different flavors, which without seeing, I would not recognize. It was like so intense. I'm tasting food, but I can't define it, what I've been doing all my life. So I actually thought that, you know, this was a message from the God that I need to understand and teach others too about how these individual flavors, I was not able to take them for granted.
Hello, my name is Vikas. I'm a chef and I'm here to teach about vision of palate, which is my research on the flavors of the food and how they react to the mind.
Hi.
It's such a pleasure.
The way to taste a fresh leaf is that you rub it between your fingers and the friction and the heat of your palm releases the oil. If I give you the name, you can relate to the word right away. I want you to smell it and tell me, what do you smell?
Wow, let's see.
Flowers.
Yeah. It sort of smells like incense, you know, when a Catholic, you know, when you go in a Catholic church. Oh, it smells good.
I don't know what it is, but outside my bedroom window, there must be a garden or something, but I smell this thing every once in a while, especially after it rains.
Rain, see?
Yeah.
It's rosemary.
Oh.
Oh.
This is rosemary. I couldn't How identify.
It is that flavors are more reminiscent of the memory than the name sometimes.
I'm Nancy Miller. I'm the executive director of Vision Services for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I think what's so fantastic is to be able to give an opportunity to hear about the spice and then be able to taste it and touch it at the same time. For visually impaired people, you can go into a store and not see what it looks like, and it's not always convenient to go over and touch and feel everything. This way, there's a comfort about tasting it, smelling it, and then touching it and feeling exactly what it's like.
I want everyone to have a sip of water, because now what I'm doing is totally different. I mean, you're getting the dried spices. I bake mint leaves.
Mint, oh, it's amazing.
And then I crush them.
Crush.
Oh, wow.
Just a touch of this on your tongue and have a sip of water. Does it hit between the nostrils or something?
The nostrils.
It's a very universal reaction.
Yeah.
And suddenly you feel your nose is opened. Like suddenly after Sudafed, your nose is open. Just a touch of this flavor, what it can do. And they're all different. What amazes me that, you know, God has given us so much, such a gift of all these things. And they're edible. And they are so much of flavors to our life. And our bodies, we react so human. We react so similar. That everyone reacts the same way about this.
And it's a good, like, breath mint.
Yes. These workshops are basically for everyone. You know, everyone who eats, who enjoys foods, who understands flavors. What I went through as my experience of not being able to see, it really exaggerated the effect of spices on my mind. It really magnified the whole cuisine, the underlining statements of flavors and everything. That's what I want to bring to people.
Indian chef Vikas Khanna's cooking school is Sanskrit Culinary Arts in New York City. Reporter and producer Rachel Bonham Carter is based in New York. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, plum season is just starting to roll down. So the question is, what was the original and rather racy name for the green gage plum? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle, online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was about those green plums in the market. Now, the question was, what was the original and rather racy name of the green gage plum? Well, the name was, and still is, French, Reine Claude.
named for Queen Claude. The plum commemorates a rather generous portion of her anatomy that resembled the fruit. The green gage plum's English name came from Sir William Gage, who planted that French plum in his garden in England in the 1700s. Now, green gages have great sweet tart balance. Now, you probably know the trick of halving the plums, dotting them with butter and sugar, and running them under the broiler, but I like the idea of plums as salad fruit, especially when they're not fully ripe. I mean, think about this. Wedges, all tart and crisp, set off a salad. They're good with greens, maybe with some blue cheese for contrast, but they're also great as the main event. Think green, red, and purple plums with fresh basil, a little red onion. Then toss them with rice vinegar and maybe some cream instead of olive oil. You pile that next to your next grilled salmon, and you're going to feel like a genius.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe
the lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the lines. We have got Agnes on the line from Kingsport, Tennessee. Hey, Agnes, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. I have a lot of lemon balm growing in my garden. I have a little plot right off my kitchen, and it's a very attractive plant.
Oh, it's a lovely plant. Yeah.
I tried putting it in some brewed tea, and it didn't have much flavor at all. And I'm wondering, since I have so much of it, what can I do with this lemon balm?
I've done the same thing. I've grown it, and it comes back. It's a perennial.
Yeah.
And it's just lovely. And I agree with you. I mean, I've put it under the skin of a chicken and then grilled it. I've made a big bed of it on a plate and then put a whole grilled fish on it.
Ah.
And more for fragrance than flavor.
Okay.
You know, using it instead of parsley and that kind of thing, because the fragrance is lovely. I have never, like you, I have never gotten, you know, unbelievable flavor out of lemon balm.
Uh-huh.
But you know what I love to do with it, though, is take the leaves and throw them in salad. You get a little bit of lemon flavor, but if you do it in a salad of, you know, baby arugula and little baby dandelion and that kind of thing and some bib lettuce, it's really tasty. It's really nice.
A great suggestion.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, it's fabulous in your bathtub.
Really?
The fragrance.
Ah.
You put it in hot bath water.
Okay.
You know, it's you and your bouquets of lemon balm.
The
other thing I've done with it is I've just picked masses of it and put it in pots around the house.
I see.
You know, as a green, as a, like, instead of flowers.
Oh.
And it smells, on a hot, humid day, it smells so fresh and cool.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we have quite a few of those in Tennessee. So.
Well, yeah, I know you do. So this will cool down.
I will be sure and try that.
You know how lemon things make things feel cooler?
Yes.
And it's a wonderful thing to have around the house. It really is. So try those.
I shall.
As you lounge in your bath, your lemon balm bath, you can have great pots of lemon balm in the bathroom. It'll be very elegant.
Well, that sounds absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Agnes. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have Missy from Frankfort, Kentucky. Hey, Missy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'm so glad to talk with you. I was listening to your show a couple weeks ago, and you were talking about caramelizing onions.
Right, yes.
And
yes.
I had just cultivated some out of the garden and thought, gosh, what am I going to do with all of these? And I went right to the kitchen, went right to work, and did everything like you said, and it came out great. And we have used them time and time again. And I looked at them, and I thought, well, gosh, can I use these as a base for French onion soup?
Of course you can.
So I was wondering, is there a difference between using, like, the red onions and white onions, or does it matter?
You know what? It really doesn't matter. there are so many different, you know, within red onions, within white onions, within yellow onions, there are many different kinds. The only kind that you don't want to use for general cooking are the very sweet ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally when you cook them, and you use them where you need onion flavor, for anything from a French onion soup to whatever, they flatten out.
Okay.
But any onion, you want an onion that has real character to it. And I find that whenever someone says like a sweet white onion, you know, like a Spanish onion,
mm-hmm.
I cut into it and I try to eat it raw and, you know, I'm tearing.
Yeah.
Because the real sweet ones will be, have names. They have Maui or.
Vidalia.
Exactly. But I'd say any onion is going to give you dynamite caramelization other
Great.
Than the sweet ones.
Great.
So, oh, I'm so glad you did that. Isn't that the greatest thing to just smear on?
I mean, my husband put it in his omelet. He put it everywhere he could put it. We ran out of it like in a week.
Well, we're by the way, guys, what we're talking about is this idea of the caramelized onions that you just keep and you use, like jam, like, you know,
yeah.
salsa, like whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I. You know what I actually did? I was raised on cream cheese and jelly sandwiches on whole wheat bread.
Uh-huh.
And I've done the same thing with, you know, the onions, and I keep them around. And what I did was I actually just took a big whole grain, you know, one of those tough artisan loaves, spread
yeah.
on the cream cheese and put on the onions, and I sprinkled a little bit of vinegar on it.
Yum.
It was really good.
Gosh, I'm going to try it.
Hey, Missy,
wonderful.
You go. You caramelize, girl. You
I
just
will.
Have a blast.
Lynn, it was great to talk with you.
Hey, thanks for calling.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. We have got Carmen on the line from Crestwood, Kentucky. Carmen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm having a 50th birthday party for my mom.
Oh, congratulations to your mom.
Yes, and I thought it would be fun, instead of torturing her with an over-the-hill party, doing
oh,
kind of a...
Oh, don't do that.
No, I won't. Doing a fun kind of retro theme, and I thought it would be neat to do foods from the 50s. The problem is, I was born in the 70s, so I don't know what those foods would be.
And even if you were born in the 50s, you probably weren't paying a lot of attention
That's
at that point
true.
In your life. 50s, this is the beginning of the packaged foods and the prepared foods and the mixes and all that kind of thing. It was really the beginning of the food industry taking off and industrialized food production. You could really have a blast with this.
Good.
Because this is the time of things like, well, first of all, I think Tupperware started in the 50s.
Okay.
I mean, it'd be very funny to have things served
in Tupperware containers.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe even if they're a shallow Tupperware. Is it going to be a buffet?
Yes.
Everybody could have their own shallow Tupperware container instead of a plate, you know, that kind of thing. And then cake mixes started being really big in the 50s.
Okay.
Jell-O desserts. They were around for a long time, but in the 50s, the idea of serving something fancy that was jellied, and it was also the time when you would have something like lime Jell-O with shredded carrots in it and marshmallows.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of thing would be really kind of fun. And you know what else? Sauces, little cocktail meatballs with grape jelly.
Oh, okay.
Cooked with grape jelly, and then beef stroganoff was a big thing at that time.
Okay.
And believe it or not, barbecue.
Oh, okay.
And especially meatballs cooked in barbecue sauce.
Okay.
Which is great finger food. And by the way, it's, you know, I'm thinking you want something like beef stroganoff or whatever, because you have a lot of sweet stuff that came out then.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think. I think clam dip.
Oh, okay.
I think clam dip. And you can make homemade clam dip.
Okay.
Which would be kind of nice. And Cobb salad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Cobb salad. And that's really nice because that's not a sweet thing. And also that borders on being real food.
Yes, it does.
Cheese Whiz, I think, started.
Oh, okay.
If it didn't start then, it started around then.
Okay.
So I think you've got the idea.
Yes.
And I think maybe, the other thing, meatloaf had been around forever, but it really became very, very popular at that time.
Okay.
Everybody had a recipe for meatloaf.
All right. Well, that sounds great.
I think they could have a lot of fun with this. You know, in 50s furniture and 50s design and fabrics are so big now, you could do a tablecloth or something.
Well, that sounds great. I love the Tupperware idea.
Yeah, I think the Tupperware is going to be a hoot.
Well, thank you so much.
And happy birthday to your mom. And how great to give her a party.
Yeah, we'll have fun.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Call us at 800-537-5252. Who's up next? We have got Carol on the line from Enid, Oklahoma. Hey, Carol, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm wanting to talk about seafood. Since we live in a small town, we have really no availability of fresh seafood. And even when we buy it in a market, it's been frozen and then thawed out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wanting to know if markets and restaurants are required at all to label seafood as farm versus wild, and are there really risks, health risks involved in farm-raised? And if there is there a difference in taste and preparation between farm-raised and wild?
I'm not sure about the regulation part. I know that in where I live in Minnesota, we are seeing labeled packages that say either farm-raised or wild. And in some stores, they make a real point of labeling. I'm not sure if this is required by law. I kind of doubt if it is. But I think what is happening is there is a movement, I know in Alaska at least, you know, with salmon.
Mm-hmm.
There is actually an organization of fishermen and people who ship who actually label wild salmon. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways, by the way, you can check all this, Seafood Watch, go to the website for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, mm-hmm. and then click on Seafood Watch. You can find a link on the Splendid Table website, too, because Seafood Watch is sponsored by the is done by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And what it is collecting information from around the world on the ecological aspects of seafood, where the pollutants are, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
All right. But now the rest of the question is, what are the concerns? There is some concern about farm-raised seafood. There are exceptions to this, by the way, because there are people now attempting to do this in a non-polluted way. But there is a concern about pollution and farm-raised seafoods. And I know the people who are doing much of the farm-raising are trying to solve the problems. But most people seem to prefer going for wild if they have the choice. I think in some cases wild tastes better. But I don't know that that's true across the board. And then going backwards, can I just go back to the original thing you said? Because it rang a bell to me when you said how you can buy your seafood where you live.
Mm-hmm.
If they're defrosting frozen seafood and selling it to you, you have a nanosecond to cook it and get it in prime shape.
Right.
It's really better to buy it frozen, believe it or not.
It is. So, in other words, I'd be better off looking in the frozen section.
Exactly, because commercially frozen fish is often done as soon as the fish is caught. It's done in a way that all of the juices of the fish, you know, are intact. It's not that the fish has been sitting around and finally they get around to freezing it. They do a very fast flash freezing. Now, anytime you defrost anything, you lose moisture. But I think you have a better chance with frozen fish and either defrost it in ice water or defrost it in the refrigerator, never on the counter,
mm-hmm.
because you can die. I think it's one of the ways I've realized, how do you get this point across to people, you know, especially with fish? If it sits out, you really can turn very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, buy frozen fish. And you know what? I would buy the wild. If you have a choice, buy the wild.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, I really appreciate your information. It was nice talking to you.
Thanks for a great question.
Take care.
Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Well, Jim Denovan is chef at Gabriella's in Santa Cruz, but he's also a man with what you might call a mission. He calls it outstanding in the field. Jim is on the phone from near Whitehorse, Alaska. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jim, you're a chef who works in Santa Cruz, but you roam the country doing these dinners. Tell me about the dinners.
Well, we arrange to have dinners on farms across the United States. We set up a table for 100 people. We invite a cheesemaker, a fisherman, the farmer, winemaker, the artisans of the table, and a guest chef. And the guest chef creates a menu.
Huh. So some examples of where you've done these.
Last year we went across the country. We went to Peonia, Colorado at about 5,000 feet, which is a fruit-growing region.
Mm-hmm.
Also a lot of game like elk and that kind of thing. bison, and then we went to the Midwest outside Chicago and did a dinner out in Long Island in the Hamptons, and then down to Athens, Georgia. And this year we went all the way up to Alaska, in a farming area in Alaska.
How did you start this? I mean, where did the idea come from?
Well, as a chef in Santa Cruz at Gabriella Cafe, we had a number of dinners, and the whole meal was centered around one farmer's crop. And then the farmer would give a little speech, and everyone loved that so much that I thought to myself, well, why not take it right out to the farm? And the first dinner was I think it was a real eye-opener for a lot of people, and the enthusiasm has continued, and here we are 5 years later, going across the country.
But how do you get people to come?
Well, we've had almost 50 dinners so far, so there's a bit of word of mouth. Also, we have a website, which is outstandinginthefield.com, which has our schedule. We've had a few customers that have come to 17 different dinners across the United States.
They're groupies.
Yeah.
They're groupies.
Yeah, they are. That's a little extreme, but generally you're coming into an area and people hear about the dinner and then they reserve. And maybe 20% of the table is the artisans of the table, the people that produce the meal. And generally it's one person per course that's an artisan of the table, and they give a little speech during that particular course. Perhaps there's some cheese, or maybe there's a beekeeper. The dinners are always different in each region. And, of course, from region to region, it's going to be a different menu.
Do you travel with your equipment and everything?
Well, we travel with the table and chairs and the equipment to put on the dinner. The guest chef provides the kitchen staff, and in a way, we're almost like roadies for the rock stars. we set up the stage, and the various players take their places, and they do what they do, and it's a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. Jim, thanks for talking with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Jim Denovan is founding chef of Outstanding in the Field and chef at Cafe Gabriella in Santa Cruz. For more information, check out the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this Hebrew proverb. Spread the table and the quarrel will end. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.